were saying that that native exemption would, you know, prevent their adequate management of marine mammals, or the walrus in this case. They also are, their argument was that the native exemption, when it turned over to the state managed, was no longer applicable. But the Togiak people argued that the exclusion was total, that the act exempted native populations from management. A state could have continued management. They could have continued managing the walrus, provided that they recognized this native exemption, and state was not willing to do that. And I think that's a very crucial point to be made, that they did not want to manage walrus with the native exemption in provision in it. 81 amendments. The way the act was amended in 81 was to remove that total exemption, and that the way the state would take management would be that rural residents could hunt the walrus. And there's a big difference. There's no longer this total native exemption, but rather a rural resident requirement.
Thank you. Well, I think we'll move on now, having sorted out the question whether the exemption went with the retrocession. I thought that was a good phrase, and I wrote it down. I do appreciate what Larry and David have said. And well, Jim Kowalski, we have you down to tell us what initiatives are being taken by Tanana chiefs in relation to native management of subsistence, self-determination in the subsistence area.
Thank you. As I understood it, what you had asked for was roughly what you said. You stated it yesterday as, what are people doing to help themselves? And
all
I
right.
think that's
right.
that's just another way of putting it.
Let me
start by first stating the obvious, which is that I certainly do not in any way consider myself to be an expert in subsistence. I'm hired as a technician who deals with the system, so to speak. And in the program that we have at the Tanana Chiefs Conference, which is called Wildlife and Parks, the idea there is to give technical assistance to fish users of the resources and to village governments to help in any way that's possible to be sure that those users are directly involved in the system that allocates, that manages, and I might try to describe some of those things that we're doing. I should say, though, that the Tanana Chiefs Conference or region is the largest of the 12 regions in the state, otherwise known as the Doyon region. It includes all of the interior, and TCC is one of the 12 regional nonprofit native corporations. The region that we cover extends all the way from the Brooks Range South Slope on the north, that would be as far north as Arctic Village, to the Tok Northway area near the Canadian border to the south, and on the west near the starting to the lower end of the Yukon River, Holy Cross, all the way up to Eagle on the Yukon-Alaska border. So we have a very large region, and because of that, the region is divided into six subregions. And so we have, just to explain to you how we function, we have a central staff in Fairbanks, and then we have six sub-regional offices with smaller staffs in six other locations throughout the region. We have a board of directors which consists of the 40 or so chiefs of the native governments of the interior. And then from those 40, there is an executive board which meets quite frequently. And then in addition to that, each sub-regional office has an advisory board. And so they set the program for us and tell us when we're doing right and tell us when we're doing wrong. The economy of the region is very heavily oriented toward the harvest. And so subsistence surely is very important to the communities of the TCC region. In the case of the Yukon River, the harvest does, of course, include commercial fish. Many people who are subsistence users of both fisheries and other resources are holders of limited entry permits. I shouldn't say many, maybe not nearly enough, but there are commercial fishery activities within the context of the rural economy, which of course includes subsistence. In terms of things, initiatives that people are trying to work with, that are taking to help themselves, I might mention trampoline registration, and I should explain particularly to our Canadian friends here that the system of trapline protection in the U.S., certainly in Alaska, is nowhere near as sophisticated and as advanced as it might be found to be in Canada. In fact, to register traplines, that is to document the location and the use and the history of the use of that trapline so as to protect it, is a very new concept to our region, and I think for the most part throughout the state. There is a trapline registration system now in place by the urban trappers of Fairbanks, who call themselves the Alaska Trappers Association. And what is ironic here is that the urban trappers are going out and systematically documenting their use, while it is taking some of the communities that have interest in traplines also, that is the native communities, are just now trying to play catch up. So we have said very little about this in public because it's not firmly in place, but I would describe to you the trapline registration system for the village of Minto. Minto is located very close to Fairbanks, and the use of the Minto flats by Minto people is extensive, and in terms of history it goes way, way back. But because of the fact that Fairbanks is so close to Minto, and because Fairbanks is really, in effect, a little anchorage, and maybe not so little anymore, has 60-some thousand people in the greater Fairbanks area, the conflicts of resource uses, including trap lines, in the Minto Flats is becoming fairly much of a problem. So the Minto Village Council, through the Elders Conference, actually, who first alerted the Tanana Chiefs Conference to the need for a trapline registration system, the Minto Village Council, which is what we call an IRA government. Some people ask what that means, by the way. It's Indian Reorganization Act. It's one type of native government that we have. The other are the traditional native governments. There are about 17 IRA governments in the TCC region. The rest are what we call traditional native governments. But the Minto Village Council, that is the native government for Minto, did put into an ordinance a trapline registration system. And then they elected a trapline board to adjudicate trapline disputes and in other ways to try to manage the system. Now our role in this was to go out and give technical assistance to help with the mapping of the traplines, to help, that is actually to register the traplines, and to work directly with the trapline registration board and the council to try and get this system set up and in place. One of the, I wouldn't say dilemmas, but one of the unanswered questions is, if there are trapline disputes that cannot be adjudicated, let's say between perhaps a Fairbanks trapper and a Minto trapper, then the question is, well, what does the ordinance mean? And that would be a question of Indian law. And at this particular point in time, Minto has decided that the emphasis should be on a careful documentation and a attempt to adjudicate differences. And so the Minto system is perhaps going to serve as, in our region, as a model for other communities. Communities on the middle Yukon River have shown an interest. Most recently, the Yukon Flats has expressed an interest in investigating the different types of trapline registration systems that might be available. So this is one area or one initiative that is being taken to protect traplines by carefully documenting and keeping up to date how those traplines are used. I perhaps am glossing over many things about this, but I would like to go on. A type of initiative that is being taken within the TCC region is to get the approval of pending applications for IRA constitutions. One of the most recent that has been in the news a great deal as of late is the application by the Village of Eagle to have approval from the Department of Interior to put into place a so-called IRA government through approval of an IRA constitution for Eagle, a Village of Eagle. An area in which this program that I work with makes a great deal of effort, and it's really the central focus of the Wildlife and Parks program at Tanana Chiefs Conference, are the Fish and Game Advisory Committees. And I'd like to just have your indulgence for a few minutes and talk to you about these. I haven't heard a great deal about them here, although I did miss the first day. The Fish and Game Advisory Committees, as probably most Alaskans or all Alaskans here know, is a system that is a state system. That is, it's funded by the state of Alaska through the boards of fish and game by the legislature. It is a system of statewide advisory committees that meet to serve as a local forum for all concerns that are of interest to fish and wildlife users. The Fish and Game Advisory Committees most typically would meet twice in the year to put together a series of proposals to the Board of Fisheries, which those users feel are needed. These would be proposals that would change the allocations, the bag limits, the gear types, the seasons. And then typically that Fish and Game Advisory Committee, for example, there is one in the Yukon Flats. Let's just use that as an example. Then typically the Yukon Flats Fish and Game Advisory Committee, once having done that, would then elect a member to go before the Board of Fisheries and defend those proposals. All of those support costs, including the meeting of the committee out in the Yukon Flats, as an example, and the sending in of the representative from the committee to the Board of Fisheries meeting, all those costs are paid for by the state of Alaska. Steve Behnke yesterday mentioned that these are reimbursable costs from the Department of Interior. That is, if the state puts up a certain amount of money, the Interior Department is supposed to put up a similar amount. So this is a state system. And then typically the Fish and Game Advisory Committee from the Yukon Flats would meet then two more times in the year to do essentially the same process for game. That is to say, they would sit down and decide and determine what are the needs for allocation of game resources, including trapping, what changes should take place, and then they would formalize proposals based on their collective knowledge, and then they would submit those to the Board of Game, and then similarly they would elect a representative, most likely the chairman in each case, to go before the Board of Game to be present there at the game board meeting in Fairbanks or Anchorage, wherever it happens to be, and to defend that proposal and to be present to answer questions. So that's just a very quick, rough sketch of the Fish and Game Advisory Committee system, but I should point out that we have in our region, I think it's 12 committees now. One, of course, is Fairbanks, which is an urban committee, but all of the others are rural committees. And for the most part, all of those committees are heavily made up by local native people. In some cases, I should also point out, and not many cases, but in a few cases, some of the participants have been discouraged by their own reservations, let's say, about participating in a state system because of questions of native sovereignty and so forth. But for the most part, I think what the way these committees are viewed in the region is that right now, you know, at this time, at this point in time, these committees are one of the best tools that native people have in rural interior Alaska to deal directly with the makers of the regulations for the taking of fish and of game. And we try to travel to all the Fish and Game Advisory Committee meetings. We try to be there to present any kind of assistance that we can. If it means taking minutes, we've done a lot of that. If it means explaining some things that are happening in the city where so often they happen and the news of that never reaches these areas, then we do that as well. So that is, in a nutshell, how we try to work with the Fish and Game Advisory Committee system. And I think, for the most part, it is advisory, of course, but under the new D2, or Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, some people refer to it as ANILCA, there are tighter provisions for the ways in which the boards of game and fish must receive those proposals from the Fish and Game Advisory Committees. And that would be that now there is a system prescribed in ANILCA of regional councils. There are six of these. The regional councils are made up of the chairman of all of the advisory committees in each of the six regions. Regional council in the interior typically may meet twice. The regional council's advice to the boards of game and fish on specific allocation issues are supposed to be followed by the boards unless there is a very good reason, and I can't enumerate them now because I don't have it in front of me, but if the boards feel that the regional council's advice is not sound, there is a loophole there, I'll use that term, for the boards not to follow the advice of the regional councils. But in any case, the regional council system, I'm certain, was envisioned as a way to give more authority, that is, more participation and more meaning and more weight to how the proposals come to the boards from the rural communities. And, of course, the urban communities are members of those regional councils as well. On the central Yukon, we have now, when I say we, I only mean it's a generic term. It's not Tanana Chiefs, but there are several fisheries organizations that have been organized. Most recently this summer, a central Yukon fishermen's organization came into being as a result of a dispute with the fish buyers over fish eggs. That has not been resolved, but it did spawn, if I may use the term, a new fisheries organization in the interior. And I understand that fishermen up and down river now are more interested in looking into the possibility of trying to deal with the market conditions and so forth through a fisheries association. There are now, as I say, two that we are aware of, and we do give assistance to them as well. The proposed Caribou Agreement, or Caribou Treaty as we prefer to call it, has been discussed yesterday. I should only add that the Tanana Chiefs Conference does give technical and logistical assistance to the International Porcupine Caribou Commission. We have also in our work program a fish, well, for lack of a better term, a fish and game education project. But the idea here was to try to find some funding in which we could put together an educational program that would essentially explain as clearly as possible the system of fish and game advisory committees and regional councils. What this eventually evolved into is a video project which is just now starting production with the assistance of funds from the Alaska State Legislature and a matching grant from the Rural Alaska Community Action Project known as RuralCAP. It would be a 28-minute production which would be duplicated in numerous copies that could be used anywhere within the state of Alaska, and the emphasis will be on using that system to make changes in the regulations that are needed. And as I say, this will be a statewide project. That is, as we're putting it together, we are doing that with an eye toward having it be useful throughout Alaska. And of course, particularly with an emphasis on subsistence, there will be in this production some effort to portray to urban viewers the importance of the harvest of rural people. So that is another initiative, as we might call it, that is that has been taken and is underway. Additionally, I mentioned to you that because of the close proximity of the village of Minto to Fairbanks and the substantial conflict of uses and users there, we have undertaken, with assistance from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a study to very closely look at the conflicts of resource use in the Minto Flats. I should say, too, that that study is being done in coordination with a subsistence, Alaska Department of Fish and Game subsistence study in Minto. That is, the department is looking closely at household uses in Minto. We are trying to assess, through a contractual arrangement with a private contractor, all of the other uses of the Minto Flats so that in the end we can put together a complete picture. I should say I beg the indulgence of a member of the Board of Game who is present here. I should say that all of this came from an unsuccessful attempt by the advisory committee that represents Minto to put into effect before the Board of Game a system for moose hunting that would restrict or would banish the use of aircraft. That attempt failed. One of the board members, not the one present, I should hasten to add, did say that he was not convinced that there were conflicts out there. And I thought right at the moment when I heard him say that, boy, you've just given me one of the best ideas I've had yet for a grant proposal. And since that time, the proposal was funded, and we are going to, in a sense, show him, but of course many other people, that indeed there are conflicts of uses. And if this priority law means anything at all, it's going to have to mean something, hopefully, as a result of what we can show from the study. There are other attempts to take initiatives to participate directly in the, land use decisions. For example, just now completed is a very extensive Tanana Basin land use plan that was mandated by the legislature and conducted by the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. In this study, there was a person in another program area within TCC who has dogged that thing closely for 2 years and has worked very hard on her part to be absolutely certain that DNR went to every damn village and that the villages were fully apprised and were participating completely in every phase of the Tanana Basin plan. So that would be one example. Then we have the, and I should say too that in the work that we do, we are, as Dave Porter mentioned this morning, trying to convince Canada that there is a legitimate and long-standing use of land and resources. He mentioned extensive use and occupancy studies that have gone on in Yukon, including a mapping of uses and, of course, harvest documentation. And I think that this is also very, very important in our region. And some communities, very understandably, are still reluctant to have their own uses of lands and resources looked at carefully. But I think now there's more and more acceptance of that. The Department of Fish and Game, again, Subsistence Division, is doing a lot of that work in the interior. They coordinate with us very carefully. They also provide us with a great deal of advice on similar matters that we're working with. So I feel have a very good relationship there. The federal regime of resource managers is the usual array of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has 7 national wildlife refuges in the TCC region, very large refuges. And they are in the process of a mandated by the ANILCA Act. Once again, we're trying to follow them as closely as possible and to be certain that local people are as involved as possible in this. To give you one example, our board of directors asked the planning team for the Canute Wildlife Refuge and the Koyukuk Wildlife Refuge to actually hire local people on the planning team. We submitted that request perhaps 3 months ago. We still have yet to receive an answer. But we are trying to be aggressive on behalf of these communities with respect to refuge planning. The National Park Service manages some of the lands within our region, and they have, as you probably know, these so-called subsistence resource commissions. I think they were two years late in putting these commissions together. The first meetings now have taken place this year. There is a Gates of the Arctic Subsistence Resource Commission, which has now met twice, is planning a series of village hearings this month, up in the area south side of the Gates of the Arctic. And on that commission are some local users. I think there are at least 3, possibly 4 native people from the immediate area. There are problems with the National Park Service. I maybe don't need to hash them over again. But we see them as being, unfortunately, very rigid, particularly in questions of access. So perhaps the statement that was made to you the day before I got here, but which I heard about, that people maybe on the North Slope, or at least in that area, are having the same access to lands and resources as they have always had, may not be entirely true. Certainly, Gates of the Arctic National Park at the moment seems to be one area where this may not be true. There are substantial arguments going on, mostly between Anaktuvik people, that's out of our region, but how those arguments are resolved will affect the way people to the south of Gates of the Arctic, which is within our region, also have access to subsistence resources. The BLM is involved in extensive land use planning in the interior. There is a reference to it in Steve Langdon's paper in terms of the TCC involvement with that. To their credit, for the first time ever, they have tried to do some subsistence mapping as a part of the Central Yukon Plan, so-called. We've felt and argued with them that they should be commended for doing it, but they've done it in a very hit-and-miss fashion with not enough seriousness, quick visits to communities, and that perhaps the end result might be more damaging than useful. So that hasn't really been resolved very well, and the BLM now has four alternatives for the Central Yukon Plan, which they are unveiling, and then there is a public process that will go on here for the next 4 or 5 months in which our communities can respond to the alternatives for the Central Yukon BLM plan. Another initiative that's being taken, I hesitate to speak in any way very deeply about profit corporations, but the land bank provision in Anilka is one in which a corporation can put its land into a land bank. I think they have to renew the application each 5 years, and then that land is managed by the federal agency that is closest by. In the Central Yukon region of the Central Yukon River, there is a land bank application by a consortium of 3 or 4 village corporations there. Those lands, if that land bank application is approved, would be added temporarily on a continuing every 5-year basis to the Koyukuk National Wildlife Refuge and would be managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service under a joint agreement with that particular corporation. I understand that the Interior has not yet responded to that application. It might have been the first one they've gotten or one of the first, but that is an initiative that's being taken to not lose the land for a variety of reasons that it might be lost, and yet to have use of land for harvest purposes. I should also mention that in Anilka, the wildlife refuge system does have a unique feature that is one of a kind. That is, all the refuges that are so-called D2 or Anilka refuges, many millions of acres of these lands in Alaska, have as a stated intent of Congress, as one of the stated intents of the creation of each of these refuges, the opportunity to continue subsistence harvest. I haven't given you an exact quotation, but that is unique language. Congress has not said that about wildlife refuges anywhere else. And so we feel, particularly through this planning process that Fish and Wildlife Service, who manage these refuges, are going through, that we must always assert or remind the planners and later and ongoing the managers that Congress has told you that you must manage this refuge as one of its purposes to continue subsistence opportunities. Let me just quickly go on. Another initiative is one that involves water quality. There is a reference in Steve's paper to Tuluksak, which is outside of our region, but Tuluksak, probably more than any other community, has put the issue, or the conflict between diminished water quality and local uses of water being harmed by that, on the map. But in our region, in the interior, the distance between the bedrock and the top is very thick. We have a In other words, geologically speaking, there's a thick overburden of what turns out to be muck that has to be stripped away before a placer mining can take place. And as a result of all of that, quite a number of the streams that have in the past supported fish and have supported other subsistence activities have been damaged. The state and the federal government have also not maintained the water quality standards for those streams. This is becoming a bitter debate. And the initiative that's being taken here in the interior is that TCC, along, let's just leave it suffice for now to say, with other interests, are coalescing to try to take the initiative in a variety of forms upcoming. I might mention one of those creeks is Birch Creek, and there is a community of Birch Creek on Birch Creek. This river is so muddy that people there say they no longer can catch fish in the river. In the case of Minto, again, I keep coming back to Minto, there is a perception there that water quality damage from placer mining has actually destroyed or harmed the habitat for water animals, principally beaver and muskrat, that it has actually affected the harvest, therefore, of beaver and muskrat. And other perceptions locally are that it has even affected the habits of waterfowl and therefore the harvest of waterfowl. So we're trying to take a political initiative in this case to try and convince the state that they have to be much more aggressive. But of course, there are reasons why this will be difficult to do. Within this context, there has been interest from our Kuskokwim, Upper Kuskokwim subregion in McGrath, of actually looking into the possibility of rehabilitating the salmon runs in some of the Upper Kuskokwim watershed, where elders have clearly told us all that there have in many years past been heavy runs, that is heavy in the local context of king salmon, where there are no longer any runs. And so we'd like to, in the sort of the context of water quality and fisheries rehabilitation, look into the possibility of what would be necessary to reestablish salmon runs in the Upper Kuskokwim for local users. I should mention now some problems. I hate to just give a laundry list of those, and I try not to do that. But I didn't hear any mention here, and I'm not being critical, I may have missed it, of an organization that's springing up around the state called Wildlife Safeguard. I'm sure many of you from Alaska have heard about Wildlife Safeguard, but basically what it is attempting to do is to raise private monies in order to pay informants to lead to the conviction, arrest and conviction and so forth of violators of fish and game laws. And what causes us a great deal of concern here is that we can see what the implications might be for rural communities who have no idea, you know, how this is supposed to work and what is going on. Wildlife Safeguard, as I understand it, and I could be misinformed, although we have tried to look into it fairly carefully, does now have a board of directors here in Anchorage. They plan to establish a board of directors in Fairbanks and in two other locations in Alaska. I've forgotten which those two might be. It may be Dillingham and Juneau, but I'm not sure of that, so I could be wrong on that. And I suppose, to be fair, the turning in of wildlife violators certainly does have its place. I would say in the Fairbanks area, this is particularly true, where a great deal of wanton waste of moose in particular, and caribou to some extent, has taken place last year, and I understand not quite as bad this year, but there's a lot of it again this year, principally by urban hunters, especially by hunters who come from the nearby military bases. But in any case, I would just caution that we try to be alert to Wildlife Safeguard. One theory that's running around, I don't know whether to subscribe to it or not, is that this is really a front to raise money nationally for the effort of actually going back to Congress to amend Title VIII of ANILCA. That may sound far-fetched, and I often feel that there are conspiracies all over out there. So I can appreciate why this particular individual felt strongly about this, but he felt that way, I believe, because he was told that Wildlife Safeguard does have money donated from as far away as Boston, for example. So we might try to pay attention to that. We also have seen a strong organizational effort by the sportsmen of the state of Alaska in what has now coalesced into what is called the Alaska Outdoor Council. The council is poking its head into a lot of areas. You've heard maybe about some of the areas, if not about the council. But I just want to mention here that it does concern us greatly And part of what I am supposed to do is to develop information about what all these people are doing and what they're planning. We do try to keep track of them as much as possible. I should mention then one final initiative would be what we call the Rural Alaska Resources Association, or RARA for short. RARA is a statewide organization of nonprofit corporations that is a representative from each and the North Slope Borough and the Village of Tyonek. And RARA meets 2 to 3 to 4 times a year, mostly to exchange and coordinate the exchange of information. It's a program sponsored by RuralCAP, and at the present time I happen to be the chairman for RARA. But I do call your attention to the fact that your region is supposed to be represented on the RARA Board of Directors, and again the primary function there is to coordinate regional concerns and to keep information flowing back and forth on a statewide basis. A rural cap does also allocate some staff support to RARA. In closing, this is just a value judgment or maybe a question on my own part. It certainly doesn't represent TCC policy, but I'm oftentimes puzzled about how the subsistence priority law might work in certain situations. But what I'm seeing in the interior is a heavy urban use of resources, particularly game, particularly moose and caribou. In fact, now it is so heavy in some areas of the interior that these people, never mind the rural folks, these people are literally stumbling over each other. I understand that, for example, on the Taylor Highway, which connects South Central Alaska to the village of Eagle, that the caribou hunt there this fall in late August, early September was just exactly that, that it was just chaos because of the tremendous number of people along that road, and they were getting in each other's way. And of course, there was a lot of shooting from the road, which is illegal, and so forth. And again, not being there firsthand, but hearing accurate reports, what I consider accurate, many, many of these people are military personnel. And I don't mean to attack the military necessarily, but what I'm starting to hear now in our region from fish and game users that I work with is, what are the state's obligations to build up big, large populations, say, of moose in a particular area? How far do they have to go to meet the needs of the military? And in the case of Game Management Unit 25D, which is the Yukon Flats, presently there's a part of the Yukon Flats, there's presently there a very restrictive moose hunt put into place by the Alaska Board of Game, in cooperation, I should say, with the local advisory committee. The board feels, this is just my interpretation, but I feel, watching the board very closely, that it feels a constitutional obligation to rebuild a moose population there. Or as one of the members says, to turn it around. And on first blush, that seems all proper, because people there do complain about not being able to harvest enough moose. But now I'm starting to hear questions out there from the Yukon River. What are the state's intentions of rebuilding this population? In other words, is the intent here to reopen this area to the normal influx of urban hunters who then once again compete with local hunters? I can't answer that question, but I find it very interesting that it's now being asked locally. Maybe I'll just stop on a question.
Yes, thanks, Jim. Heather Myers, you had a question. Just come forward to a mic and ask it. Could you repeat the question for the microphone?
Can you tell me a little bit more about the trapline registration program that you spoke about? I was wondering. You mentioned that it was set up to resolve disputes. What kind of disputes is dealing with?
Well, the disputes that might typically take place or are taking place in the Minto Flats, which is a geographically in Alaska terms is relatively small, but is really the breadbasket for Minto and to some extent Nenana hunters and trappers. The conflict would be, let me just give you kind of an example, and you can consider it partially true and maybe partially untrue to illustrate the point, that in the flats in a particular region there might have been an area that was trapped, that is three trap lines by, in this case, people from Minto, going back to the early 1900s and maybe possibly earlier than that. Then those trappers, over a period of time, might not go back on that trap line to allow the fur to rebuild, as they say, in other words, to give the area a rest. In the meantime, along comes the urban trapper from Fairbanks, maybe with an airplane or maybe with a snow machine. It's that close to get out there by snow machine. It's possible to do. And he sees this area and decides it's going to be his. So he takes it over, not only in fact, but he also registers that line with the urban trappers. And in the case of the Alaska Trappers Association, one of the purposes of their registration is to document the use so that they don't lose their trap lines, whether it's from other trappers or whether it's from the state of Alaska selling the land or BLM or other planning going on, you know, disposing of that land in a way that destroys the trappers' use of it. So they will show their trap line registrations publicly. And so we went out where those records are kept recently on Chena Hot Springs Road at Tax Store. And the gentleman was very accommodating, in fact gave us the whole book to take down to the restaurant, and we did that. And a person who works with me, Ronnie Silas, who is from Minto originally and knows whose trap lines those really are, he said, boy, the hair on the back of my neck just stood up when I saw those registrations from the what we might refer to as the Urban Trappers Association, because they are directly on the trap lines of people from Minto who have left them rest for several years. So that's one of the types of conflicts, and it's probably the most prevalent one. But there are also other trap line losses that are coming from oil and gas lease sales, from settlement programs of the state of Alaska for its lands, and so forth. So this would be another type of conflict that a trap line registration that carefully documents the use might help to avoid. In fact, a resolution by the Alaska State Legislature, not this past session but the one before it, not a statute, mind you, but a resolution, does state that the DNR shall now consult with the Alaska Trappers Association and the Tanana Chiefs Conference before doing any land disposals. In a sense, it was a little premature because we hadn't done the mapping yet at that point. But anyway, that's another type of conflict that might be at least mitigated somewhat by a good documentation, which is part of the registration. As I said, the part that is not clear to us and would probably require court tests is what applicability does Indian law have to these trap lines. And typically a trap line might start on a native allotment, on native land, or native corporation land. And then it might, just because that's the way it's always been, it might cross out over some state-owned land. And then it might even get onto a patch of federal BLM or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service managed land. So it's possible for a trap line to extend outward over several jurisdictions now. And whether or not Indian law, for example, the Lacey Act, the amendments to it, could be applicable to that trap line, not only from its point of origin on native land, but across these other lands as, say, Indian country, which is a legal term here, whether or not that is going to, that remains to be resolved. In other words, it's a question that hasn't been answered. But the people that want the trap line registration system feel it's important to get something carefully documented in place. So that's the first step.
Peter Usher, you had a question?
Yes, I'd like to comment on the registered trapline system, if I might, perhaps to give you some impression of what its advantages and what some of its disadvantages might be. But perhaps before I do that, I should get a bit of clarification from you. Do I understand that there never has been a system by which traplines were actually registered under the authority of the state here? Or, I mean, is this just a trapper's association business where they register their own lines, or what?
It's the latter. The state has never instituted any system of the sort. So the system that is in place, that is the Alaska Trappers Association, is a private organization.
Okay.
And they have the first registration system.
Well, I guess the registered trapline system is perhaps a distinctive Canadian institution then that might be worth saying a few words about. My perspective on it is based on having done research for Native communities and Native organizations, chiefly in the Yukon, NWT, British Columbia, and Ontario, all of which have, for part or all of their territories, a registered trapline system. I would say, and it's common in most of the provinces in Canada, I think possibly my comments might not apply to Quebec, but Harvey Fite perhaps could say something about that. Well, the origin, and I should also add then that, considering who I've done the work for, my perspective reflects that I think more the impact of the registered trapline system on Native people, rather than, so that my perspective is not necessarily shared by the game management authorities in any of those jurisdictions. The origin of the system in Canada goes back to the 1920s in British Columbia and to the late 40s and early 50s in the other jurisdictions. And it was instituted chiefly by the resource management agencies, the Fish and Wildlife agencies. Well, why did they do that? Well, it was justified sometimes as a means of protecting the interests of Native people, who in these jurisdictions usually constituted the majority of the trappers. But if one inspects the files of the Fish and Wildlife, the contemporary files back in those days of the Fish and Wildlife Services, you will find often that what they're really trying to do is protect the interest of white trappers who were coming into the country and wanted to make sure that they could make a living off these things without being interfered with by traditional trappers. And I think there was another factor at work there, and it is a widespread perception, which I think still prevails a lot as a philosophy in game management offices, and that is, it was a means of overcoming the evils, the perceived evils of the as they pleased and not take care of the habitat and so on. And so what they perceived they were doing was implementing a system of private property rights which would allow a better conservation of the resource. Considering the arrogance which typified game management in that era, not surprisingly, there was an assumption that there was in effect no system, traditional system, on which they were imposing this. In other words, there was no recognition that there was a whole traditional system of trapline tenure, if you like, in most of these areas, that was either based on families or extended kinship groups or whole villages or whatever it happened to be. So there was an assumption that we were just replacing a free-for-all with a private property system. Now, the other party that had some interest in seeing that system come in was the Department of Indian Affairs, who because again, if you look at the historical context in which this system came in, it was during a time when the trapping economy was declining very seriously because of low fur prices and so on, and in some cases was imposed in a situation where traditional harvesting practices had become quite disrupted by virtue of this economic problem, by virtue of epidemics and so on had caused a considerable disruption in the traditional use patterns. Indian Affairs sought to protect the interest of the native trappers to a greater extent, and tried, although the impetus for this came from the resource management agencies, Indian Affairs tended to try and speak on behalf of the local native populations to say, look, this is their economic base, you must make sure that they get some of these trap lines. And in fact, for the most part, they did. I would say that the chief disadvantages that Indian people perceived of the registered trap line system would have been three. One was that by making a private property institution out of what had generally perceived to be a collective property, community property, if you like, was that the trap lines became dissipated over time as individuals could be approached by white trappers and say, gee, I'd like to buy your trap line, I'd like to buy your trapping rights. And in some cases, if you look at the history of tenure over a period of 20 or 30 years from the 40s to the 60s or 70s, what you see is a gradual decline of Indian tenure in favor of non-native tenure of these trap lines. So in a sense, it's analogous to what happened to reserve lands in the United States that were given over to individual. Another is that, and this is quite commonly expressed, is that people felt that their traditional systems of running their trap lines were unduly interfered with by this system, because no longer could they operate the system of leaving some areas to rest and using others and going on this kind of rotation over very large areas on an extended family basis, that they had these smaller areas to which individuals, they couldn't cross over to each other, they couldn't use each other's properties, or legally they couldn't, although covertly a lot of these things continued on. And the other was that in some jurisdictions, at least, there were performance criteria on maintaining these trapping rights. So that, and I should add that all of this could be done despite treaty obligations and so on, because this was seen to be a commercial right rather than a subsistence right. And that, I suppose, the added effect of that was to separate out trapping as a commercial function, as a means of getting access to traditional lands, whereas in fact, in the eyes of the people, trapping was only one of many things that had gone on. So these performance criteria, that in effect raised the usual sort of double bind that native people often find themselves with respect to resource management agencies, which is that either you're using these resources too much, so we'll have to clamp down on you, or you're not using them enough, so we will reallocate them to somebody else who will use them more efficiently than you. Now, I'm speaking of a situation that's for the most part past history, but I think it's worth remembering why this system came into effect and what its impact was. Happily, I think it's not been all disadvantage. As often happens, people take these things and turn them around to their own advantage when it's least expected that they might do so. And of course, in the context of claims negotiations in a lot of these jurisdictions, the game management authorities have put a halt to the performance criteria and to turning over trap lines into non-native hands, pending the outcome of claims negotiations. And you've heard a lot of the proposals that people have in the different jurisdictions to transform this system. But let me then mention one or two of the positive features of the registered trap line that could be to advantage. One is that being a kind of individualized or resource tenure, it has been argued in the case of Alberta, I've seen a legal argument to the effect that this ought to be the basis then on which people could receive some kind of compensation to which they might not otherwise be entitled, because normally trapping is not considered, a trap line or a trapping license is not considered to be a right that can be compensated when it's interfered with by a third party. The argument that was made in Alberta was that in fact the nature of the license that the province had granted was in effect the same as what would be given to let's say an oil company, which was in effect a right of profit à prendre. In other words, that if that was interfered with, that there was some kind of compensation due to the third party that interfered with it. And that is reflected to some extent in very recent years in compensation regimes in some of the western provinces, which have enabled trappers now to obtain compensation in situations where I think they would not have before. And I think the other thing that may be turned to advantage with registered trap lines in Canada is that not all of them, fortunately, have been made to individuals. There are such things as group registered trap lines. The Yukon people referred to some of them in the northern part of the Yukon this morning. They also exist in the western part of the Northwest Territories. And in the past, trap line which is registered to a group, let's say to a community, has been a means by which the community has been able to regulate the entry of other parties onto their trapping area. And for example, in the case of Banks Island in the Western Arctic, which was a particularly abundant area for Arctic foxes, the Inuit community there for many, many years successfully controlled entry into trapping on the island, which they would not have otherwise been able to do without the instrument of the group registered trap line. So, and of course what that offers now is the possibility of some kind of a group property which could be compensated for, I suppose. I should say that that's not in effect at the present time, but I think the arguments are there that could possibly create that situation. So I certainly don't want to discourage you from adopting what might seem to be a great idea. Maybe you should pick and choose from the kinds of things I've talked about as to where it might be to your advantage and where it might not be. I think there are some pitfalls with the registered trap line system, but also advantages.
I wonder if I might suggest that we take a break now, and then after coffee return with any additional questions we have for Jim Kowalski, and then we'll hear from Willie Goodwin about the management of the Western Arctic herd, and from Weaver Ivanoff. And if there is time after that, from Harvey Fite. And tomorrow we'll hear from Dan Gross about third world subsistence regimes. And then we'll return to general discussion of basic issues. I hope that Joe Meeker and Dick Nelson and Peter Usher and Gary Holthaus, Gary's going to be returning tomorrow, and Dr. Mike Holloway will all participate at that time. So let's take a break for coffee now. But not about the Western Arctic. I think I have a scooter.
When tree trap lines were set up, they were made exclusive to me.
Are they?
Why?
See, it wasn't any other jurisdiction.